piece of duct tape. Sorry, we're duct taping our thing.
Duct tape
in here. Monica can duct tape.
Exactly. I can duct tape people. That's I don't know that I just did anything.
That's okay.
But
we're jerry-rigging our interview here. All right, we're starting. All right, Monica, I'm here with Monica Lewinsky. Monica, welcome to Sway.
Thanks. Hi, Kara.
So I just want to say the backdrop here is Monica and I are in the jankiest studio in West Hollywood. It smells like pot. It's where Snoop Dogg does things, clearly. Mm-hmm. And the microphone is taped. It's just
yellow duct tape.
Yellow duct tape into a diamond
candelabra.
It's, if we sound funny during this entire interview, you know what happened, which is not necessarily a good thing because it's like the New York Times and you expect it to be the highest level. And now we're getting high in West Hollywood. In any case, there's so many things to talk about. We're going to talk about technology. We're going to talk about your documentary on shame. But I want to talk about the FX show first because I think it's where you've gotten a lot of attention lately. Beanie Feldstein plays you. You were a producer on it. There's been a lot of series about the Clintons, very few about you. This one is different. Tell me why you wanted to be involved.
The American Crime Story impeachment is really tracking three different women's perspectives
right.
from 1998. And there are three women, including myself, who were in the margins of power
right.
at that time. And I think that we rarely see, I mean, certainly the history books from that time period are written by men, and the perspective is usually shaped by men. So with the show, you know, Ryan had this perspective.
This is Ryan Murphy.
Ryan Murphy's perspective coming into this. And what was intriguing to me was the idea of looking at this story through different lenses. So my story is a narrative in the 10-part series, but it's
right.
not the only narrative.
Odd fact, Ryan Murphy and I were interns at the Washington Post.
Oh.
He was the world's worst intern at the Washington Post.
At the Washington. I think I sort of probably took the
title
of world's worst intern.
I just can't believe I said that. Oh, my God. No, he was. Actually, if I'm going to stack rank you. All right. So what was it like seeing someone playing you?
It was bizarre. I mean, Beanie is an extraordinary young woman. And, you know, it's really interesting because I think it was shortly before Ryan and I had dinner to talk about the show and sort of seal the deal, I had seen Booksmart.
Right.
And there were moments in Booksmart, even though Beanie was playing a senior in high school, there were moments where I just felt, God, there's something about her that reminds me of me. There's a certain age where you're just becoming an adult and you think you fucking know everything.
Right.
And you think you're ready to take the world on. And you don't, of course.
Right.
You don't really understand consequence. I mean, we're, of course, responsible for our actions at that age.
Right.
But I think that there was a humor to her, but a sadness.
Yeah.
And she sort of seem to be able to portray in different characters I've seen her of just that thing we see of, right, smart women making dumb choices.
Yeah.
So
one of the things that I think people don't understand about you as well is how funny you are.
Oh, thank you.
And people have a narrative around them.
Mm-hmm.
When you thought about doing this, though, it's the way you want to be portrayed, correct?
Well, you know, this has been a huge learning curve for me because I had never been involved in mm-hmm. a dramatic series before. So
right.
I think the tango for me of understanding emotional truth and dramatic license and how you can't take several years of time and when you condense it into a 10-hour episode,
mm-hmm.
you know, understanding what that means, understanding how you have to make all the pieces of the puzzle work. And there were a lot of things that I think are incredible about the show. There are some things that I wish were a little different.
So did you have creative control or veto power?
No.
No.
I had no creative control. I felt very listened to. I was able to give notes on everything. I'm sure I gave far more notes than anybody would have
yeah.
ever wanted.
Yeah.
You know, and in all ways, I mean, Ryan has creative control of his projects, and he definitely listened to me.
Right.
But being listened to and being heard doesn't always mean you get your way.
Right. Now, one of the things you said is you felt that you shouldn't get a pass because you're a producer. Talk a little bit about that, meaning portraying you not as an angel or
right.
A heroine.
I mean, look, I'm a flawed person. I'm a good person. I think I'm a kind person, but flawed. I make mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes when I was younger. I still make all sorts of different kinds of mistakes as an adult.
Although, Monica, no one's quite paid for their youthful mistakes as you have, I think.
It's very true. I lost It was a very high price. I lost a lot.
Yeah.
Not just then, but the long shadow of the repercussions, mm-hmm. you know, will have forever impacted how I was able to move forward in some ways.
It completely defined you in a way that was indelible in a lot of ways. But let's keep talking about the show for a second.
Right. So just to answer your question, look, there are so many mistakes I made in that time period that I wish I could erase mm-hmm. and I wish didn't have to be in the show. But I think particularly because I was a producer and because I wanted people to see the truth of a lot of these stories and what happened, it was obvious to me when I got a script that didn't have this one incident, you know, this like I very clumsily flirted. I'm not a very good flirt. And I very clumsily like did this thing with my thong underwear and showed an inch of it. It's a whole big long thing.
Yeah, I recall.
And that wasn't in the script. And my first reaction was like, yes, that's amazing. Great. I don't want to have to go over the tropes. Mm-hmm. And when I thought about it, I realized, you know, if this isn't in here, people are not going to trust the show. They're not going to trust all of us as producers and storytellers. And I shouldn't get a pass. And I recognize that that was important as much as I wish it didn't have to be in there.
Right. I'm astonished that I know this fact. It's really kind of gross. So I'd love to go through this in a very quick way, sort of a lightning round. Mm-hmm. Your favorite moment on the show, did you have one?
I do. It's a little bit of a spoiler alert.
That's okay. People know the story.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know what? I think people are surprised by how much they think they know and then how much they're learning. Like even me, my margin notes, did this really happen? So there's a moment in episode 6, which is the FBI sting, which is how I found out about the investigation. And there's, it's making me emotional. There's a moment where in the Crate and Barrel, where Monica is with the FBI agents in the middle of this, you know, horrendous 12, 13-hour day. And there was this feeling of, it sounds crazy, but it was this feeling like somebody would be able to look at me and they would be able to sense that I would like mental telepathy. Help me.
Right.
Help me. I'm in trouble. Help
me. Yeah.
You know, and so there's this moment where Beanie, as Monica, looks at the salesperson, and she just nailed that moment.
Right, which is get me out of here.
Which is help. Yeah, I need help. Everything is not okay.
Yeah. Was that the most difficult moment for you to revisit?
No, there was sort of an irony for me around the episodes, and I've only seen 1 to 7 so far, where, you know, the dual hats of subject and producer, where I left and I'm shattered because I'm so triggered.
Right.
And it's like, oh God, this is so hard. And then the producer in me is like, God, this is great. It's great that I'm triggered.
Right.
Like if I'm triggered, it means the emotional truth has been captured and people are going to really experience this. And so there were a lot in, it is so, Kara, it's so hard. It's so hard to watch, you know, quote unquote, myself, like making stupid mistakes. Like you just think, you know, don't smile back. Don't say that. Don't flirt. Walk away. Be shy. And then also with Linda Tripp, it's a split screen for me in my lived experience of the flashback of what actually happened and the flashback of what I'm watching, but I now know more, you know? So that is, it's really challenging. You know, it was very challenging to see. And, you know, every time I do something connected to this story, it sort of allows me another layer of healing. I think it's just been, you know, shame is not something that just goes away.
No.
It clears in layers. And so I've had to really work hard to just try to forgive myself more.
Well, you're not allowed to leave it behind as other people are.
Yeah.
You know, or bury it very deeply. So what was a moment that was relieving or affirming?
Episode 7, I sobbed just reading it. I think that they did an incredible job of capturing the first few weeks of what it's like to go from being a completely private person who didn't want to be a public person.
Mm-hmm.
I did everything within my power, including signing a false affidavit, for this to not become public. I mean, obviously, it became public because I stupidly confided in somebody and and it became public because I engaged in it. So, I mean, but I think people will be surprised to understand and to see what it's like on the other side of the double-sided mirror. Right. What does it feel like to see yourself on TV?
Right. Your character spends part of that episode on the couch watching TV coverage of the scandal. Mm-hmm. The coverage is brutal. I remember it.
Yeah, me too.
At the time, I thought it was brutal.
Thank you.
I got a sense this probably was the worst part for you, is seeing this happen, you becoming a trope, mm-hmm. a character, a reductiveness. The reductiveness that exists today, to me, began then.
Yeah. And then I think, too, there's, you know, something I couldn't see until I was much older was the famous finger wagging scene.
Yeah.
Of scene. I call it a scene. As if, you know, it's like it was a moment.
It was a scene, Monica.
It was a scene. And in the moment at the time, I was so young. I was so traumatized. I still had these feelings. It's not like everything had been over with Bill.
Right.
And so I still naively loved him. And I was glad at first because I thought, oh, good, he can save his job. I didn't want him to lose his job, in part for him. And I think in part, some part of me just thought, I don't know that I could live if I really am responsible for all of this shattering. But
Monica, there is Bill Clinton.
I know. I know that now. That was me at 24.
Okay.
That was me at 24. But what I also see now, and I think we see this, and this is where it's very interesting and weaving into more of today's stories too, is that he laid out the game plan. He signposted for everybody, that woman. I did not have sex with that woman.
Right.
And that was it. He was going to deny it, and I was fair game.
Were you surprised?
Naively, I was. Part of me was. I mean, Sheila Nevins once said something really interesting to me, some version of, it's impossible to imagine other people doing things that you yourself could never do. And so I think that it was, he knew me.
Right.
You know, so it was one thing for people who knew of me, maybe who worked in the White House, but he knew me as a person. And I get it, you know, politics is the oxygen, his oxygen.
So many people would absolutely run over their mothers if they needed to. That's what I, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is a type of person who does that.
Particularly in DC.
Yeah. You know. So there's a scene where, speaking of mothers, your character of your mom tries to get you to turn off the TV and you won't let her.
It's funny. My friends and I talk about this a lot now with social media around self-harming,
right.
You know, where it's sort of like, don't look at the new girlfriend's Instagram.
Right.
It's just self-harm, you know,
right.
don't look. And I think that there was an element of self-harm there for me.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that is, I had no fucking idea what was happening.
Right.
You know, I would have to watch the news. You know, most people forgot this or didn't know. All of my friends who knew, who were also 24, were dragged before the grand jury. And I wouldn't know who was going until I'd see on TV that morning and just sort of think, okay, I hope I didn't say anything about them on the tapes that they'll never talk to me again. And so it was my source of information.
Right. But you also couldn't, it's like looking at an accident,
exactly.
But you are in the accident.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know?
And I don't know if this is everybody. I'm someone for whom information feels safe. Nobody does well in uncertainty. I do really poorly in uncertainty.
Right.
And so I think there was a part of me that also thought the more information I have, like I could be strategic, you know, how do I think about this? And I don't know whom I can trust.
Yeah. The other part of it is that, I know this sounds funny, but you were besides the point once it got out.
Yeah.
You hardly mattered
in
what it was. You became a trope,
mm-hmm.
a narrative, a
tool. Yeah, it was one-dimensional.
A tool for either side, which was really interesting.
Well, and it's, I think that that's too, and that the Clintons had the left, Linda Tripp and Paula Jones had the right, and I had nobody. I mean, I had my family, thank God.
Right.
But I mean, in terms of a public narrative, I think, you know, and that's kind of one way where social media may have been helpful. I don't know. But the only way I heard from people was either they mailed me a letter, they made a comment somewhere online, or they had something that was attention-grabbing enough that they could get into the paper. Like, I know from my friends that people would initially, when they were asked for comment, if they said something nice. It didn't make it anywhere. Nobody was interested to hear that I was a decent person. Even still today, sometimes people will say, if someone finds out that we're friends.
I want to get to that later. You have mega fans, especially women, who do not know you. But at the time, you were caught and not willing to pull aside the way that others did, like Paula Jones, who I found great poignancy in her portrayal.
Anna Lee Ashford. Yeah, she does an incredible job.
That is an incredible thing, Anna Lee Ashford.
You know, I think we're finally at a point, you know, hopefully, where both sides are saying she never should have been invited up to that hotel room. Full stop.
Right.
There is nothing else to say.
Well, it's that she had to find refuge in the right.
Yeah.
So talk about this. So much of the Clinton scandal you mentioned has been originally written by men like Ken Starr. Mm-hmm. This show is written by a woman, Sarah Burgess. Mm-hmm. It's the women who are at the center of the story. You, Linda Tripp, Paula Jones. Why is that important from your perspective? Obviously, I found great empathy for Paula Jones and Linda Tripp.
Well. Yeah, me as well. What I think this allowed us to do, and Sarah Burgess did do a great job, is I think that the first thing that went out the door in 1998 was the truth, and the second was context, you know, and there's no nuance. And we were all women who were thrust into the spotlight underneath a political film or sheen. And we were all reduced. We were all reduced in different ways to serve purposes for other people, for either political points or to make money.
Right.
And so I think that everybody working on the show felt that humanity is what we want people to walk away with, this understanding of humanity for all these people.
How do you think about Linda Tripp now?
It's complicated for me because I had a very bizarre thing happen. I started to do a really deep and intense sort of spiritual work maybe 13 years ago, which I still do.
Yeah.
And I never set out to sort of forgive her or let go of the bile. But one day something happened and I realized I'm not carrying around that bile around her. I don't get that indigestion. And you know, it just, I think there are times she's popped up, things she said. I mean, she's passed away now. So there's no version of me that understands why she did what she did. Her narrative of that she was trying to help me, I think there are myriad ways that she could have done that, that if that were true, she would have done.
Well, she was seeking relevance. She had been shuttled aside.
Exactly.
She was one of those very Washington people that are at the center of things but really aren't important.
Mm-hmm.
She had no power. And this gave her power by stepping on you.
Right.
Or using you, really.
Right. Which is a very Washington thing to do.
Right. But it only brought her shame, which is...
Right. I mean, she gave a speech a few years ago at a... what's the word? See, the pot's getting to me.
it's all not planned, Monica.
I know. Whistleblower.
Yeah.
Okay. So she gave a speech
at... It's called Hot Box Sway.
So Linda, I think the tragedy for her really was that she didn't have the self-awareness to recognize exactly what you just said. And so she had to couch it in all of these other terms that just really don't add up. You know, I read an interview that her daughter gave to Vanity Fair after the first episode, remarking on, you know, that Sarah had captured and this, and both Sarahs, so Sarah Burgess in the script and Sarah Paulson on screen had captured Linda's intelligence and her wit. And she had both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a dynamic spot in a place that, you know, the Pentagon is so different from the White House. Everything is kind of this bland, fluorescent light colored gray khaki. And here I am, you know, raised in Beverly Hills, went to college in Portland, Oregon. The White House internship is a pit stop on my way to grad school. You know, I did not fit in at the Pentagon.
You're both exiles is really what happened.
Yeah,
is how
exactly.
You met each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So are you, I'm not saying forgive Linda Tripp, but did you feel satisfied with this portrayal of her?
Yeah, I think, you know, look, it was complicated for me. I think there were times, in all honesty, some of my script notes, some were looked at, some were not, where I felt there was too much sympathy.
Yeah.
But then there were also times where, you know, I had to kind of have a talk with myself and sort of say, you know, I don't need to worry about that. I need to worry about, you know, what's my truth and what's here, and let people judge me for me. And I have to try to focus on something higher, you know, a higher purpose. Like, yes, of course, there are all sorts of selfish reasons I participated.
Right.
But then there is also a really important reason for me around moving the conversation of this forward, ensuring that something like this doesn't happen to a young person again, that if they are taken advantage of, you know, 75% of the blame should be on the person in power.
Right.
You know,
I would say more like 90, Monica.
Okay, 90%. 90%.
In this case, I'm giving it a 99, actually.
Okay. And, well, you know, I may be, okay, let's, how about 85? 85 and 15.
You're being kind. Your life has been so derailed by what happened between you and Bill Clinton. How do you feel about the fact that your life has been so altered and his has not in a lot of ways?
You know, I've had moments of bitterness about it, but how I feel now is I don't really need anybody else's life to be fucked up. I just need people to not stand in my way. You know, I think where it is important, you know, my background is in psychology and social psychology. And so when I'm always stepping back to look at the bigger picture,
right.
And when I look at the bigger picture, where I see it as problematic is, what does it mean for society? Like, what would it have meant if he had stepped down? What would it have meant if he had been meted a punishment that was appropriate at the time for something like that? Would that have then ended up changing history in different ways? Or we see now, too. I mean, when the news came out about Ken Starr being so involved with Epstein,
you're
like, oh, my God, the two most powerful men from 1998 in this investigation, Clinton and Starr, and they're both tied to Epstein.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that. I'm not in any way drawing a parallel between what Epstein did with these young women and what happened between Bill and myself. But I think that the fact that these two men could then ride along on their power and end up there, that shows us something, you know? And also, too, I think people of a certain age and a certain stature, they end up not changing, not being forced to change. And that's the irony of where I was lucky that I was the youngest and least powerful is because the only way forward for me eventually was I had to do, I hate saying the phrase, I had to do the work on myself. I had to evolve.
Right. Yeah.
But
that's why I'm curious. Did the Republicans approach you to speak out against the Clintons?
I have had outreach.
Especially during the Hillary campaign. You did not.
I've
always been struck by this.
I did not. Yeah.
All the others did.
It's, first of all, no matter who was more at fault, I was engaged in something in any time in my life when I'm engaged in any kind of behavior that causes pain to other people, I regret that. So it's just not my way. I'm just not vindictive that way.
Right.
And not to say that those women are vindictive. They have every right to have their own feelings. That's just not my path.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. There was the ladies at The View were thrashing me. You know, and I hear this a lot. It's, you know, if look, fair game. If I'm doing things, people get to say what they want to say. But the thing is like this idea of making any kind of money on a past history. We never talk about.
Are you kidding me?
But we never talk about what people turn down.
Right.
You know, the millions and millions and millions of dollars. Because I just didn't. Yeah. I just didn't think it was right. That just wasn't right for me. I don't want to, you know, pass judgment on anyone else. It wasn't right for me. I always wanted to just. Which thankfully I have more of now. I just wanted to be seen for my true self.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Why shouldn't you tell your story in a factual, classy way?
So I
don't even understand
right.
that.
I think that there's, I mean, I don't know if you'd agree with this or not. I think our political views are sort of our most salient aspects of our identity. I mean, maybe gender, you know, or sex, but I think they're up there. And because it was sort of this mix of sex and politics and it was the first baby boomer president.
Yeah.
So there were just so many different things.
And the earlier attacks on the Clintons, the actual right-wing attacks.
Yeah. I am certain that you would be able to find a day in history where you had Paula Jones being attacked for various things, probably her looks, Linda Tripp being attacked, the same things, Hillary Clinton being attacked for the same things, myself being attacked for the same things, like misogyny, you know, has no party, no party loyalty.
Yeah.
So, and I think that I think that we've gone far, far away from what politics should be.
Right. There's also women attacking each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I interviewed Hillary Clinton in 2018, I asked her if she wanted a do-over of the comment she made you. Privately, I was more strong. I thought it was wrong, and you deserved an apology. She wasn't able to do it on stage. She got close, and we had a very thoughtful talk about it. But do you think that pitting her against you has been one of the most disturbing of all the narratives? Were you against Linda Tripp?
Right. I agree. I think that...
I still think she owed you an apology, but go ahead.
It's,
maybe
this
you owed
is
her
a,
one, too.
I do owe her. I publicly apologized, and were I to have the chance privately, I would do so, too. I think that this is part of woman versus woman is part of, it's one of the playbooks in the patriarchy, you know, and so I think that it is some of the worst ways, but we do it to ourselves.
We'll be back in a minute. Let me get to your documentary, 50 Minutes of Shame. And one of the things that I thought was most important was a review of this show, Impeachment, which said, in the show, you can see a lot of seeds of what is happening now, with the media picking apart with an emphasis on sexual politics and extreme partisanship. Can you make that link to now? Because this is what you're talking about in this documentary.
Absolutely. You know, we're kind of asking these two questions of how did we get here and where are we going? And the how did we get here part is what really fascinates me. We can see this thread from when shame started to become monetized, when it went from being out of the town square onto the printing press. And then, you know, you add in things like Rupert Murdoch and tabloids, and the tabloid culture started to infect every area of our life. And this could have ended with Princess Diana's death. She was killed by the paparazzi chasing her. The paparazzi were chasing her because they make money from the tabloids, from the photos, right? So there was this moment where we could have pivoted, and we didn't as a society. And so what happened then is all of a sudden, the crash of all of these cultural things with 24-hour news and the competition that had started to happen with 24-hour news and the internet. And so I think that that's what that meant is that the storylines were louder and were around longer. We also were starting to see with the internet right around there blogging. And so people who were non-experts who normally wouldn't be published had a public platform.
Right. And you had done this TED Talk where you said, as far as the culture of public humiliation goes, what we need is a cultural revolution. Public shaming as a blood sport has to stop. It's time for the intervention on the internet and in our culture. The shift begins with compassion and empathy. Online, we've got a compassion deficit, an empathy crisis. It's worse, Monica. So this is very prescient what you talked about.
Thank you.
I'm in the documentary, by the
way. You are.
I talk about
You're
it.
You're amazing. It's a 90-minute doc. So we could have done a 90-minute doc just on
just
your interview.
Just me saying, fuck you, Facebook, right? Essentially. That's really pretty much my jam these days. But
you're not alone.
We were talking about this in the TED Talk. Mm-hmm. It has gotten worse.
It has. I think that what we've seen is a proliferation of siloed information and viewpoints. We've seen a proliferation of people learning to game the system, right? So how to use the internet for misinformation, disinformation, and chaos. And I think
which is the point.
Which is exactly the point. But what has happened is, you know, we're in this culture of humiliation now, and along with attention and outrage, public shaming, piling on people, doxing, all of the different things that can happen to tear someone apart online.
Right.
They all make people money.
Right. So you said in the documentary you wrote, our culture is drowning in something shame. I want to understand why. Do you think you have an answer to that question?
No, I don't have a definitive answer to that because I don't think it's one thing. It's not just tech. You know, there are the laws. There's also human behavior, you know? So, and I think we need to start having this conversation a little more, I don't know if holistically is the right word, but when we're talking about these things, it is to be cognizant of all of the different things that are at play. So I think the first place we can start is the place nobody really wants to start, and that's with us.
Right.
You know, and I have to do it myself. I mean, one of the things that you talk about, which I really like because I feel the same way and I try really hard to follow it, is sort of the difference between dissenting about someone's opinion and picking them apart for their looks.
Right.
You know, and so
I'm the only person who protects Mark Zuckerberg when he puts on the correct sunscreen.
Right. But I mean, I'm the same. And I didn't, you know, I wouldn't retweet pictures of Trump and his whatever his golf outfits or
his pants
or his pants, because I just thought this isn't the real stuff to go after someone. So
when you think about how this has evolved, one of the things you were asking for in that speech at TED is compassion and empathy needs to return. Mm-hmm. Again, it's only gotten worse.
Right.
I guess, why do you think that is?
I think probably because, in my view, from my political perspective, we took a pretty sharp turn. So my talk was 2015. We took a pretty sharp turn in 2016. And I think that the way politics unfurled for that election and the way the internet was used, I think it became something different. Trolls became something different. Troll farms became something different. Internet misinformation.
But isn't that just an amplification of what happened to you when you were watching those television shows?
Yes. You know, I mean, I went on the Drudge Report every day in 1998, too.
Right. It was integral to getting out. By the way, Billy Eichner plays Matt Drudge.
Doesn't he do a brilliant
job? And Colby Smulders plays
Ann Coulter.
Ann Coulter. And boy, you really do understand the power, because the internet is what got that out.
Mm-hmm. I think it was the first time traditional news was usurped by the internet.
Right.
You know, so.
In a major news story.
Right. And then when the Star Report came out, it was the first time that you missed history being made if you didn't have access to the internet.
Right.
You know, it's a fascinating.
I wonder what your scandal would have been like had there been social media. Whether, like you said, whether you would have had more power or they would have.
Right. I don't know. Here, one thing I do know, I mean, I don't know that it's the right context in which I would have been judged, but what would have existed is rather than going to my high school yearbook page to see what did I put in my stupid collage, you know, you might have seen more aspects of who I was as a person,
right,
that people would have been able to anchor. They would have seen that I was funny back then.
Yeah.
That was a joke. Yeah. So, or just, you know, my level of intelligence or what was I interested in, or not even level of intelligence, but that I wasn't a dumb bimbo.
You would have also had power.
I might have. I don't know. I might have. I think what it also would have meant is that the kind of loose rules that I had to live under in 98, why I couldn't speak for myself, had to do with legal aspects. And that just doesn't even exist anymore.
Right. You said the internet might have allowed you to speak for yourself back in 98. Yes. Mm-hmm. I wonder what you might have said if you had spoken for yourself.
Oh, gosh. I think if we lived in that world. I'm trying to think now. I try really hard to be honest. My social media, like that authenticity is really important
right now,
to me.
Yeah. You're very kind on social media, I have to say.
Thank you.
I'm not sure that's a compliment. I'd be a lot meaner.
You're a weak bitch on Twitter.
You're not weak. You're very kind.
Such a bitch.
I have
sometimes.
To slap
Don't
people
worry.
For you, for Maggie Haberman, for Hillary Clinton. I have to slap people for a lot of people.
Well, you're principled.
Thank you. So, what's been the impact of Trump? You said something turned into, was it Trump or Trump's ability to misbehave and the tech platforms doing nothing?
Right. I think it's a combination of a lot of things. I think it was the divisiveness of the two candidates and what it meant, and that we had a woman running for the highest office in the land. And I think that Trump knew how to use the internet.
He's using the way that this documentary.
Right, exactly. So going to your point, I think we were all of a sudden in a new territory. And I think that the platforms don't act fast enough.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of good, there's a beauty and a beast quality
right,
to the internet. And I think we see that in this documentary where, you know, I mean, the beast part of it in the doc are people who, you know, some people will know their story and they'll come to understand a totally different part of their story.
Right.
But you also see sort of, you know, where the beauty of it being used for like shaming for change.
Yeah.
You know, in a positive
way. You're saying
way.
It's both things. Net negative, net positive. When you think of the tech companies and what they've done, how much blame do you put on them?
I put a lot of blame. I don't put as much blame as maybe people who don't swim in this world at all. I know a lot of people who are in the different companies. I know they're trying different things. They're trying to roll things out. And I have respect for some of them. What I think is problematic is that they are not prioritizing what they should be prioritizing.
Safety.
Exactly. Safety. Particularly for women, marginalized groups. And that is where, for me, it's a little less binary. And I kind of just go, we all know we could have something better right now.
Right.
We all know that could exist.
Right.
So I don't know why it's not happening, but trying to get there. I mean, and I agree with you, you know, in your comments around Section 230, around, it's like, I think if we just, again, in the binary, either keep it or get rid of it, we're never going to get anywhere.
Right.
And that we should start, you know, by evolving it in smart ways. But so I guess the thing is with tech is that I don't even know anymore if we can say, is it better with or without, because it's here. I mean,
so it's the oxygen.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's a great quote, everyone deserves a voice, but not everybody deserves a microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are ways that our social media should be catering to that in a sense.
Well, Instagram Instagram Kids.
Yes. I think it would be very challenging to be a young person growing up today.
Toxic.
Right, especially for teen girls. I mean, Anderson Cooper did this great documentary a few years ago where they had access to 13-year-olds' social media and phones. And this stat stayed with me. And it was that 13-year-olds that they looked at would take 150 pictures for one selfie that they'd post. And what gutted me with that was this idea of what's the negative self-talk in the 149 that you were like, oh no, got to take another one. This looks bad here. And, you know, how much harder it makes it to not judge your insides by other people's outsides.
Right.
I think we look at this bigger picture of technology too, and this is where I think the platforms are failing, is it's, we prioritize being first instead of being right.
Right.
And so what happens is, you know, if you think about, for the longest time, there were certain techniques that people could do for a photograph that was in a magazine, right?
Right.
What a touch-up was. And then along came Photoshop. But yep. To know Photoshop, right, you had to have a certain level of skill.
And like here you can just...
Right. And now you have a filter. So, I mean, you see this thread of what happens through technology, and it's like we have to get better.
Do you see any solutions? I know you keep saying empathy,
I know,
kindness.
Which I do think is a solution. I mean, look, I don't have this Pollyanna view that sort of all of a sudden everybody's going to wake up tomorrow and be kind on the internet. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it happens incrementally. And those incremental shifts actually cause more seismic shifts.
Okay.
Or things like, why can we not slow down the tsunami? When something starts to trend that should trigger a bell of this person is not a public person, I'm not saying anybody's voice should be taken away, but why can't we slow down the rate at which those tweets start pelting at somebody? Because we often don't have context. We often don't have all the facts. We don't have the nuance, like the 3-day rule. You know, this idea around maybe we should just be quiet for 3 days until things come out. You know, I mean, I know.
Yeah.
Not going to happen. But still, it's about getting attention. And
one of the things that I thought was interesting was a review about your show. It does push viewers to reconsider a moment when media, partisanship, sexual politics, and celebrity took a hard turn to the reality we're living in today.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can draw a very bright line.
Yes.
And I'm not sure there is a solution because people liked it. People liked your story as entertainment, as fodder.
And on top of it, they also like to say that they weren't interested.
Right.
But I think that if there were a solution, as bright as I like to think I am, I'm probably not the person who's going to come up with it.
Right. Okay. but you felt heartened.
But I feel that I see things all the time online where strangers are being kind to each other. And when you pause, when you do find the humanity, it's not going to solve everything, but it starts to move us towards a different place. The platform's becoming more responsible. I think this idea to me of the fact that somebody can have intimate video or photographs of themselves taken by someone else or taken without their knowledge even, put up on the internet where everybody can see it and people fucking make money from it, and that can't be taken down in 2 seconds, that's bullshit. And that is not okay for us to be living in a world where particularly it happens to women, that we should have one more thing we have to worry about and have lorded over us.
Right.
You know, it's just bullshit. It's just bullshit.
So let me then end on this on cancel culture, because then you have people who say you shouldn't censor people. You shouldn't.
Yeah,
you know,
it's complicated.
It's such a politically charged term. What do you think of cancel culture?
I see the benefits and I see the detriments. And really my top feeling about it is that, and this is how I feel about a lot of things, that they become a catch-all phrase. You know, we need to actually divide cancel culture up into what the pieces are. What are we talking about? Are we talking about a Me Too scenario where someone has been a sexual predator or abused their power? Are we talking about a scenario where it's a company? Are we talking about something that's been that's a racial issue? What are we talking about? Is it a misstep from somebody who actually rarely does anything like that? Is it something somebody said from a long time ago and they've evolved as a person? So we've given this one term to all of these things, and it doesn't work to have this same cycle of behavior for all those things.
It's been reduced.
Yeah.
I call it accountability culture.
Yeah. Roxane Gay calls it consequence culture. And I think that there's a lot of truth there. I also think that it's now a thing. Like I see people debating, like, was I canceled or not? You know, I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, because it can be a public form of shaming someone.
Right, it is.
Maybe some people, it definitely is. In some cases, that's the thing.
Yeah. It 100% is a form. Think about, you couldn't really have cancel culture without public humiliation and public shaming.
Right. Who should arbitrate these nuances then? Because Twitter, like, who's running Twitter? Nobody. It's sort of like the inmates are.
Yeah, or there's that perception that one person is sitting at the top deciding the algorithm.
Right.
I think Tristan Harris talks about that.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I mean, I feel like I know it seems like I should.
No.
I think the truth is that...
I think the problem is it's nuanced and people have made it reductive.
Right. Exactly.
Did you ever think you'd have gotten involved in this kind of debate? Like, from where you started?
No. I wanted to be a forensic psychologist, so right. I wanted to work for the FBI. I was really interested in criminal profiling. So
I want to ask you just two more questions then.
Okay.
What would be a surprising thing about you that people don't know, do you think?
Oh, a few years ago, I would have said that I'm funny. Some would still be surprised that, like, I have a master's degree in social psychology. People might be surprised at how much work I do on myself, maybe. I take it really seriously. Healing and becoming a better person, if you will. I mean, certainly still flawed. I don't know. I feel like this is a boring answer. Sorry,
that's okay.
Kara.
No problem.
That I'm boring. How's that?
Boring. Okay.
That might surprise people that I'm boring.
Be surprised.
I'm happier, you know, cuddling on a couch, watching TV than out at a party.
You're much classier, broad, than people think. I think everyone in your entire story has behaved badly, most especially Bill Clinton, by the way, who could be canceled, in my opinion, in many ways. I don't know if you think that. But I do.
I think he had an opportunity as an elder statesman when the conversation was changing to be somebody who could have taken responsibility and done things in a different way if he had evolved much. But, you know, I knew a small part of him and I mistakenly thought it was all of him.
Yeah.
And I don't know him and I haven't spoken to him in 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And so I don't know who he is today.
I think many people should be ashamed of themselves. And you talk about shame, but they should have been ashamed of how they behaved and continue to behave. And I think you're the only one who didn't throw anyone under the bus, which I think is very unusual. So I'm going to ask this last question. Your name of your production company is Alt Ending. What would your alt ending be if you had to rewrite it?
Oh, gosh. Again, back to maybe the boring or the banal, my alt ending would have been I left my internship. I went to graduate school, got a PhD in forensic psychology, got married, had kids. So
you can still have alt endings, you know.
Yes, I can, and I.
This
you know
one's
what?
A good one.
I have had the last 7 years for me have been nothing short of a fucking miracle, and so I feel like, all right, well, if I've had one miracle, I could have another. So, and I have, as Pollyanna as my mom can be at times, I think she prefers sanguine, but She's always saying, you never know what or who is around the corner.
You don't, Monica.
So
you don't?
I know. Well, you can look out for my next boyfriend.
All right. I know some people, but they're not going to be assholes. You're not going to have a bad boyfriend.
First, my therapist says, we just need to find you a kind narcissist who's a little less broken than some of the
others. There'll be no bad boyfriends for Monica Lewinsky.
No, I've dated some great guys. All right. I'm very lucky.
I will see if I can do something about that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kara.
Sway is a production of New York Times Opinion. It's produced by Naeem Araza, Blakeney Chick, Matt Kwong, Daphne Chen, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Edited by Naeem Araza. With original music by Isaac Jones, mixing by Sonia Herrero and Carol Sabaro, and fact-checking by Kate Sinclair. Special thanks to Shannon Busta, Kristen Lin, and Lyra Liga. If you're in a podcast app already, you know how to get your podcasts, so follow this one. If you're listening on the Times website and want to get each new episode of Sway delivered to you by our worst intern, along with our new companion podcast, Hotbox Sway, download any podcast app, then search for Sway and follow the show. We release every Monday and Thursday. Thanks for listening.